And our next case this morning is United States v. Rabiu, case number 12-3884. Mr. Hoik.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Tom Hoik, representing the defendant appellant. Your Honors, on Monday of this week, the Supreme Court decided the case of Pugh v. United States, which deals with the relationship of the ex post facto clause to the sentencing guidelines. And if, just briefly quoting the holding, which is on page 13, the federal system adopts procedural measures intended to make the guidelines the lodestone of sentencing. A retrospective increase in the guidelines range applicable to a defendant creates a sufficient risk of a higher sentence to constitute an ex post facto violation. This is directly relevant to this appeal. I have been urging the ex post facto point all the way through the sentencing, realizing we would not get anywhere because of the Demery precedent in the circuit. The Pugh case was also from the circuit and directly overrules Demery. This case involves an application note dealing with how the definition of victim in computing the number of victims for possible enhancement under the guidelines. And it was enacted November 1st, 2009. The offense of my defendant took place in 2007. The guideline calculation that Judge Guzman did is set forth on page 5 of my brief. And he gave four-level increase for number of victims, finding that there were more than 50 victims. Following this application note, which said that contrary to the prior rule, where a victim for this purpose was someone suffering an actual pecuniary loss, if you had an identity fraud case, you counted people whose identities had been stolen and used, but who hadn't necessarily suffered a loss. So, in this case, of course, the judge made no finding about how many victims there were that suffered an actual pecuniary loss because he was using the amended guidelines. But it seems clear that it would not be more than 50. It seems clear to me that it would be less than 10 and that there would be no enhancement for number of victims. The government admitted that the only parties suffering an actual loss were the banks and one company who's was the victim of a theft of checks. And in the judgment order, the restitution is ordered only against three banks and that company. So that it seems highly likely that there was a four-level increase in his guideline range because of that amended guideline.
Assuming we agree with you, wasn't this harmless error because of what the judge said before pronouncing sentence that, you know, regardless of whether the guidelines calculation is appropriate and what any future court might rule on the application of the appropriate offense level and guideline calculation, that the judge said this is an appropriate sentence, you know, apart from that. So
I interpret that as meaning there were a lot of different things the judge ruled on. And I interpret that as just saying that I think all my findings were correct and that this is an appropriate sentence. But let me also point out, however, the judge sentenced at the top of the guidelines. He found a level 26. The guideline range was 63 to 78 months. He sentenced him to 78 months, plus the 24 months mandatory sentence for aggravated identity theft. Now, if the if that amended guideline had not been applied, and in fact there was not this extra four levels, the range would have been 41 to 51 months. Now, assuming that Judge Guzman wanted him to get the top of the guidelines, under the rule now that where you'd have to use the guidelines in effect at the time of the crime, that top of the guideline would be 51 months. So we have it would be a level 22, 41 to 51 months. So we have a guideline range that has been increased, and it's certainly not harmless error. And to say it's harmless error, you'd have to say that Judge Guzman, back before this application note was passed, would have said to himself, the level's 22, 41 to 51 months. I think I'm going to do an upward departure of 27 months, a four-level upward departure. Well, upward departures are very rare, as I point out in my brief.
Well, actually, departures are obsolete now, as we've discussed in an earlier appeal this morning. And so all we have to assume is that Judge Guzman meant it when he said, I would impose this sentence without regard to what the guidelines calculation would be, because it's an appropriate sentence. That's essentially what he said. Regardless of what any other court in the future may rule what the appropriate offense level and guideline calculation was, I feel the sentence I'm about to oppose is appropriate in this case for the reasons I've stated here today. So it's a 3553A exercise of Booker discretion to come in at 78 months on the bank fraud, which is within the statutory maximum, obviously. So why don't we take him at his word that this is what he thinks the appropriate sentence is, regardless of the guidelines calculation?
Well, because that would in effect involve a substantial upward departure, and he made no findings.
You don't have to make findings because departure analysis is obsolete. All the judge needs to do is explain why he thinks the sentence is appropriate in the exercise of his discretion, and the judge did, and backed it up with this conclusory statement at the end that this sentence is appropriate regardless of whether I've made an error in the guidelines calculation.
Well, if judges make that statement at every sentencing, there will be a lot fewer appeals of sentences.
Right. I think that's what it's designed to do.
Yeah, didn't we affirm a sentence in a situation very similar to this in the Abbas case, U.S. versus Abbas, that the government cites in its brief, where the judge made a statement like that, had a tough guideline calculation issue, made findings on that adverse to the defendant, but then said, regardless of that, this is the sentence that's appropriate for this offense. And here we have a defendant who was centrally involved in a nest of various frauds. They were interrupted by the investigation. Had they not been interrupted, my gosh, what else could have happened? So why don't we take him at his word when he says this is the sentence that I've chosen for this case, even apart from the guidelines?
Just because it's not true that if he was sentencing under the old guidelines, we cannot assume that he would have given that size of an upward departure. And so I can't imagine that harmless error would wipe out this whole area of law like that. That's, you have to. You, I mean, now in my reply brief, and I want to point out page 6, I distinguish the government's case.
Yes.
The judge in this case did not state that he would have given the same sentence even if he was in error. The judge expressed his view of the seriousness of the offense by merely saying, I feel the sentence I'm about to impose is appropriate in this case for the reasons I have stated here today. He didn't make that flat statement that, you know, even if there was an error, even if there was an error on constitutional law about the application of the ex post facto law, and thus he had to use the old guidelines, that even in that case, he would have given that kind of a an upper departure, which the Sentencing Commission says only 1.9% of departures are upward departures. So that I see that my time is up unless there's further questions.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Walk.
May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Block, and I represent the United States. The government agrees that in light of the Pew decision, there is an ex post facto issue in this case because the guidelines in effect at the time of the offense would be lower than the guidelines in effect at the time of sentencing due to the change in how a victim is defined in identity theft cases. We do agree with that proposition. However, as the Court in Pew noted just this week, an ex post facto error can be harmless where the record makes clear that the district court would have imposed the same sentence under the older, more lenient guidelines as it did under the newer, more punitive guidelines. That's in the Pew decision at footnote 8. And as Judge Sykes, you made clear, the district court, or as you noted, I should say, the district court in this case was clear that it believed the sentence imposed would be appropriate regardless of whether a reviewing court later found that a lower offense level should be applied. Therefore, the ex post facto error in this case is harmless. The district court, in making that statement, referred back to its reasons earlier in the sentencing, where it said that the sentence was appropriate because of the seriousness of the offense and the need for general deterrence in a case involving a bank employee like defendant who was engaged in a pervasive fraud scheme. The district court further noted that the defendant had gathered much more personal identity information than he was able to use, but the court found that he was clearly intending to use it. The court found that very aggravating. The court also noted that he found the defendant not to be contrite, and the court stated on the record that he had significant doubt as to whether this defendant was reformed or as to whether he would commit further crimes after his release. So in imposing the sentence, the court put significant weight on the need to protect the public and the need to deter the defendant from future criminal conduct.
Right. But on the merits, is intent to use the stolen identifying information enough to confer victim status on the one whose information has been stolen?
Well, it's,
I mean, that the application that requires use, either an actual loss, which you didn't have victims with actual losses that you could substantiate to get you over the 50-victim threshold. So you're relying on this additional expanded definition that accounts for victims whose information was actually used. And here it seems to me the decision rested on this intent to use, this finding of the court, and how is that right on the merits?
Well, Judge, as we're here today, I don't believe that issue is still on the table because since in light of Pew, it would be the earlier guidelines that would apply. We agree the number of victims would be less than 10. It is four victims now. But to answer your question, I believe as to what
Right. On the merits question that was briefed in this case before Pew came down, it's a pretty aggressive merits argument on the part of the government. Let's concede that.
And Judge, I think that the sentencing transcript is a little convoluted because it's the government's position that there was sufficient evidence to find more than 50 victims, even without counting the information that was found at his apartment. That was additional information above that would get us way above 50 victims. It was the government's view it was around 80, 86 victims that he actually used. There was then additional information found at his apartment that he had not yet made use of.
What was the evidence of use for those 86?
The evidence of use, Judge, involved whether it be checks found with the actual victims' names that had been negotiated in the defendant's name, bank accounts that had been opened by other conspirators when those victims' information was stolen by the defendant.
There was evidence of negotiated false checks?
Yes.
Involving the information of 86 of the victims?
Not all 86. I mean, you have to sort of, it's was done in so many different ways, but when you add it together, and this is what we argue at the sentencing, when you look at all the information that was stolen to open mailboxes, multiple names on each mailbox, that was all stolen information, and the Postal Service did in fact determine these are real victims. There were real victims who had their identity stolen and then used. So we get to 86 through a number of different schemes. What the judge focused on at some part of the sentencing was this additional information that we recovered from his apartment. We did take the position that that should count also. The judge agreed with us, but even had the court found against us on that, our position was we still would be over 50 victims.
Then I misunderstood. So the intent to use wasn't dispositive of the 86. For the 86 victims that the government was at least initially claiming, you had some with actual loss, some whose names showed up on negotiated checks, or whose identifying information was used to negotiate false checks.
Yes, Judge.
Some whose identifying information was used to open deposit boxes or
mailboxes at like a UPS store, what's called commercial mail receiving agency. Other information that was used to open bank accounts or credit card accounts. So that was the government's position at sentencing, was that we were over 50 before applying this other information that was found during the search of defendants.
And that is where the question of whether the mere possession of this stolen information with future intent to use it comes in. But you don't even need that to get to 86.
No, that's correct, Judge.
Well, what you're saying then is that there were some people whose identity was used, but at that point they hadn't suffered a loss?
Of the information that was used, even within the 86 victims, all of those victims, or I should say, none of those victims suffered an actual loss because the banks are the ones who suffered the pecuniary loss in this case.
They have to replenish it, obviously.
Pardon, Judge?
Bank has to pay them back.
That's right.
The depositor or whatever it is ultimately not going to suffer a loss. So it's the banks paying for their loss.
Correct, Judge.
So what I'm asking are there some who didn't get so far, whether their name had been used, but there was not an actual reduction in whatever asset they had?
Yes, Judge, that's correct, because there were some victims whose information was used to, for example, open a mailbox in their name using their identifiers. Under no circumstances would those victims suffer a financial loss. Under the 2009 guidelines the court used, they would still be counted as victims because they had their information used unlawfully and without their authority.
And then it's in place to use, I guess.
Yes.
As opposed to just having a name someplace.
Correct.
All right. I'm trying to clear up because this is kind of a complicated bunch of transactions here, and how these people pull it off. My other question is, there were a number of defendants, and I believe the judge mentioned the fact that the judge was aware of these others. Have they been sentenced as well? And
they have most all been sentenced, except for a few of them. There's two defendants who have not yet been sentenced.
Now, are they all looking at a similar, at least alleged, number of victims?
They are.
Are they all in it wholesale, so that everybody in this conspiracy is accountable for the whole number of people whose stuff was stolen?
No, Judge. There are some differences among the defendants because, as you noted, this was a very complicated fraud scheme with various moving parts. Some parts overlapped, some parts didn't. So the number of victims is not the same as to each defendant, nor is the loss amount the same as to each defendant.
Well, I'm also curious whether the judge put this caveat in all of the sentencing.
Judge, I don't recall
him. No, I'm just looking. I think one has already come along. Maybe it's successive, and I'm just wondering if we're going to be looking at this in every case.
Judge, I do recall that in the sentencing that took place recently of co-defendants, Mr. Arojajoy, that case is currently pending on appeal before this court. The judge did make a similar statement at sentencing. As to the earlier sentencings, I don't recall whether he did or not. But circling back to the issues of the harmlessness of the post facto issue, the court was quite clear as to the reasons he was imposing the sentence that he was. It went to the seriousness of the defense lack of contrition, the need for specific deterrence, and after going through all of those factors, he stated, as Judge Sykes noted, that he believed this was the appropriate sentence regardless of what a reviewing court would do in the future. So, and Pugh says that is permissible, so in light of that, we ask that the sentence be affirmed.
He got acceptance of responsibility, though, right?
He did, Your Honor.
Three levels?
Yes, Judge.
Okay, thank you.
All right, counsel, your time had expired. You can have a minute in rebuttal.
Right. On this question of whether the 86 people on the government's list were shown to have used the identity, please look at my response to that argument on the bottom of page 5 and top of page 6 of my reply brief. That misstates the record. They did not present evidence that those 86... despite my continual demands for it, and I admitted to 33, and then they presented no further evidence with regard to the other 86.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advice.